So we're happy today to interview Professor William Derman, longtime member of the Department of Anthropology at Michigan State, and a core faculty member in the African Studies Center, who's had many, many roles in many graduate students and research projects at MSU. Too many to cover in our interview time here. But, Bill, you came in 1968 to Michigan State. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your history before that? And
Before I came to Michigan State, I was at University of Michigan, and I was active in what was then called the Voice Political Action Committee. It was a student group, and I was co-chairman of their peace committee, having come out of some anti-nuclear war work in New York City. And we had the Voice Peace Committee, but Voice very quickly transformed itself into Students for Democratic Society. And in that early transformation, Todd Gitlin organized perhaps the first ever anti-apartheid demonstration at Chrysler World Headquarters, where on a very cold winter day we protested against the automobile industry's engagement with apartheid. And I also participated in perhaps the first anti-Vietnam War demonstration in 1963. It's not usually included in the histories, but I rode down together with other members of SDS from that early time. But then I went off to Guinea to do field research during the height of the movement. And when I came back and became a graduate student, I mean, to complete my graduate education, I joined New University Conference, which was then sort of the graduate organization for former members of SDS.
When was that demonstration at Chrysler?
It was in 1962. I was friends, Todd, actually, and a couple of other people lived next door to me in Ann Arbor, and I was very friendly, and that's when I really developed my interest in Africa. It was in the early 60s, and Todd knew I was interested in Africa, so he enlisted me to go with them to, I believe it was 1962.
Right, and so you did go off to Guinea and did your research there? And,
yes, in the Socialist Republic of Ahmed Sékou Touré.
You want to say a word about that research at all?
Well, the old Marxist activist scholar John Saul, when reviewing my book, said there was a lot about serfs, there was a lot about peasants, and there was very little about socialists. And in the end, there was very little about socialism at the time when I was in Guinea. And it was one of my first experiences of people who called themselves revolutionaries and said they were doing social transformation but didn't, turned out to be very severe impediments to progressive agendas in Africa.
When you came back from Guinea, was the were there African issues in the university conference or the other organization?
No, New University Conference was really focused on building a nationwide organization, kind of a left critique of both unions and education, and wanting to open up universities to members of all classes and races. But of course, a great deal of activity was really focused on the war in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. And the early activities, we formed a chapter for New University Conference at Michigan State, and we were very, very active in the early anti-war movement in 69, 1970, 71, and helped organize very large demonstrations. But we always maintained a dual focus on racism in the U.S. and the war.
So that was in 69 to 71. What was the flavor and the character of the organization at Michigan State in that period?
Well, it was a very difficult time in the sense that faculty had very cross-cutting commitments. Michigan State was a very conservative institution at the time, and we were very central in organizing a student and faculty strike in May of 1970, and that also was a watershed for many faculty in the sense that they were regarded now as really political radicals, and large numbers of people who were active with me at that time didn't get tenure. In one instance, Bert Garskoff was fired for giving everyone a 4.0 grade so they couldn't be drafted. And it was very difficult under those circumstances. Simultaneously, there was a group within the University Conference who wanted to go even more extremely to the left, and in one way or another associated themselves with weathermen or weather people, thus pushing people with families and with, you know, legitimate academic concerns really to the margins. And very quickly, the next step was, you know, we focused on opening up Michigan State to African Americans in Detroit. And we started a program in Detroit and began offering university classes. But at the end of the day, New University Conference really burned itself out and came to an end in 1972, which was really premature, but I think it reflected the tensions of the time.
And in that period, the New University Conference was heavily focused on the Vietnam issues,
Focus. We had something which was absurdly named the Detroit Geographical Expedition and Institute, whose charismatic guru was a guy by the name of Bill Bungie, who was a geographer in Wayne State, and he found a devoted follower here in Ron Horvath. And, you know, in some ways, many of us thought it was a wonderful idea, even though we thought a lot of it was quite wrong. And we attempted to open up Michigan State as a land-grant institution to the cities and to make available university education and a means for people who may not even have graduated high school but who could actually engage in university education. I, for one, taught an anthropology course in Detroit, which was free and open to absolutely everybody, but for which they could actually gain university credit. It was a four-field anthropology course, and I began teaching about evolution. And two-thirds of the class, African-Americans, thought, of course, that evolution didn't exist and it was against their biblical teachings.
That's right. Shades of another day.
Yes. And then in 1970 we had the strike. In 1971 I get the years confused. If I remember correctly, 1971 was a huge demonstration in Washington. If the government won't stop the war, we will stop the government, was the slogan. And we formed small groups here to go and participate in the demonstration. In 1972, it took place in East Lansing, following the mining and bombing of Hanoi and Haiphong.
So were there actually demonstrations on campus then, or occupation of buildings?
Oh, there were all kinds of demonstrations, and we shut down Grand River. People began tearing it up and planting flowers. There was a permanent hippie settlement in front of the International Center. The International Center was a focus. Wesley Fischel, who was one of the architects of the Vietnam policy, he used to walk around campus with bodyguards saying his life was in danger. There was an effort to burn down the ROTC building. And then there were sit-ins against military recruiters. I participated in some peaceful sit-ins myself. And then there was a very large demonstration in the Union. And so it was a very mixed thing, and there were a was a very small group of SDS people who identified with themselves at that point as weather people, you know, who kind of egged on and pushed on the crowd. The university engaged secret student spies to spy on people. It was a turbulent time. It was an exciting time, and Michigan State was a very, very active campus at that time. In many ways, at that point, it was actually more active than the University of Michigan.
So it was in that period that there was concern about South Africa arising.
Well, what happened was we had been engaged in a campaign and this was a nationwide campaign, to have cities and states sign their own peace treaty with the people of Vietnam. That since the United States government refused, to take really steps toward peace, we had this grassroots campaign, which in many ways was spearheaded by American Friends Service Committee, but a whole range of groups. And then, in effect, we saw the peace coming. And the question was, what next? And that had to do with the analysis of whether or not the problems that emerged from the war were systemic in nature and had to do with U.S. efforts to establish global hegemony, or if they were just, a stupid war and a bad mistake. And those of us who argued it was systematic held a conference, and it was called appropriately enough The Empire's New Clothes. And at The Empire's New Clothes, and I among others knew about the National Security Memorandum of 1969 from Henry Kissinger with the tar baby option and their predictions that white rule was going to stay and the U.S. should acknowledge and work with the white regimes in southern Africa. We were aware of the wars in Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau. We then put southern Africa as one of the possible avenues for continued student, faculty, community activism. And so that was very heavily on the agenda. And the group that did this was kind of this continuation of the New Left after the New Left had disappeared all over the U.S. We called it Crisis in America, whose acronym was CIA. And we used to meet, once a week. And, we had all kinds of groups and a great deal of energy for quite a long time. And so
this, what period was that? Sorry.
This was following the end of New University Conference.
After 72.
Right. It was probably earlier than 72 in a way. I was trying to remember the year that we had that failed demonstration. There were supposed to be all these busloads of African Americans who were coming up to Michigan State University, organized by Bill Bundy and this group of African Americans from Detroit. And Bob Green, the former dean of the College of Urban Development, was there saying, don't follow the whites, don't follow the whites, don't be misled by those communists. And so it was really a demonstration with a tremendous amount of tension. It was a demonstration that failed. There was no good analysis as to why that happened and how to move on from there. And that was really the end of the university conference. It barely met after that, and there was no serious analysis. And that's when, following that, was another action in Vietnam by the U.S. government, and a group of us came together to sort of reform a new group around the war. And that was led by Bud Day from United Ministries in Higher Education, who died very recently, but who was a really strong and committed anti-war activist for many years and also had organizational skills and resources. A couple of people out of the student Christian movement. And so there were a fair number of us who then put together a whole new group again.
And that group was?
Well, that group was Crisis in America. And then we had this conference, and then there was a lot of disagreement among members of Crisis in America as to whether we should address the issue of students as a class, whether we should unite with the proletariat of the United States, whether we should continue to focus on African-American rights issues and jobs issues. And my choice was not that other issues weren't important. My choice was just Southern Africa. I wanted to kind of unite my professional and political life in a different way. And so, and the people in the group felt that I was being disloyal. And at that meeting, we had Bud Day was there, Carol Thompson, a graduate student in political science who was very interested in Africa. Lovemore Nyoni, who was a Rhodesian graduate student in social work and in exile. And we were really the four core people who organized some of the students, you know, to begin moving, and we just named ourselves Southern African Liberation Committee. Our focus at that point was really Southern Africa as a whole, and it wasn't specifically South Africa at all. And that was really the origin of the group in May of 1973.
So it was in 73.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And then did that group grow in size and appeal and activity then over the next 4 or 5 years?
Well, that group began well, and we began bringing films and speakers, especially about Angola and Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau. We argued that NATO weapons were being used in those countries by the Portuguese, and therefore they were the illegal use of NATO weapons. They directly implicated the United States in those wars. And so we tried to make an argument for ending U.S. support, any military support at all, for the dictatorship in Portugal, and Portugal was a dictatorship at that time. But my history breaks off at that point, because I had decided that if I really wanted to work on Southern African issues, I should go to Toronto. And so I had a sabbatical coming up, and so I went to replace Richard Lee at the University of Toronto, and I could also work with the Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Southern Africa. It was known as TICLESAC, and everybody joked it was the Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Southern Africa and Canada. But that was silent. And so I spent the next 2 years working with them, be it a boycott of Hudson's Bay because they were selling caracool fur from white farmers in Namibia, boycotting Krugerrand as though I was going to buy any. We ran on to the pitch to protest South African cricket teams. But one of the things I liked best about TICLESAC was the intellectual engagement with the issues, so that we had every 2 weeks we had a seminar. We read all of the best available books and analyses of Southern Africa at the day and had a place and a time to really discuss it. And they also put out a journal, Southern Africa. And that was something that we never had here, although we tried. But it was kind of that in both combined intellectual and political engagement, which we never succeeded in obtaining here.
Might be interesting just to dwell a little bit on that comparison. I guess you were working with people like John Saul up
yes.
there, and you mentioned this intellectual output. You've made a few comparisons. Maybe just like to elaborate a little bit more on that comparative dimension and whether you're able to bring back and apply some of those different tactics or strategies that you saw there.
I certainly tried,
yeah.
But there were things that was just not possible to do. For example, there was an anthropologist known as Paul Puritt, and Paul Puritt worked with the Canadian youth organization, and they were deeply involved in supporting youth from liberation movements. Judith Marshall, who was there, they had the Development Education Center, and so they were supplying education materials to Canadian universities and to high schools. It was a much deeper set of people with much deeper Southern African experience, and we didn't have nearly that number of people with direct African experience, and therefore the networks. One of the things we tried to do when I did come back from Toronto was we maintained a very active connection with Toronto for about 5 years. And we would get their materials. We would bring speakers from Ticklesac. We would, you know, really try to use them to facilitate the organization here. Here was always much more focus on action and much less on the intellectual work that would support, you know, a greater knowledge of why we were doing what. But that's the way it happened. And I think back to Toronto, and some of them are lifelong friends, and there was just such a greater depth. And then we would get South African exiles who were politically committed. And we only had one person like that. There was an African-American woman who worked at WKAR, Paula Watley, and she was married to an exiled South African, Dumisani, and I forget his last name.
Matabane, I think.
Dumisani Matabane. But he was either unwilling nor capable of really engaging in that kind of intellectual and political discussion with us. I mean, my feeling in the end was he just simply took his orders from ANC, and that was his orientation. But Paula was absolutely invaluable. I mean, she made all the connections to African American community and so on. Yeah, Paula was invaluable.
So that's an interesting comparison, perhaps, that I've also seen in my interviews, is this presence or absence of a South African community that can really inject a lot of depth and maybe some tensions, but also they have this, you know, ongoing commitment. So,
right.
So here it was just the odd person, right. Dumisani. Yeah. Were there any white South Africans?
No, none who were active.
None. Yeah.
We really always relied on students and you know, and the wandering academic like myself or Dave Dwyer. We were tremendously bolstered when Dave Wiley and Mary Lee came here. I mean, that made an enormous difference. And you know, a really fine academic and, you know, committed scholar, Mike Bratton. But Mike had no time or interest in building a political group. And so whatever he did.
I wonder if this has some influence on an issue that I raised in an interview with Dave and with Frank Beeman. And that was what I discerned as a sort of an absence of polemics, like in other parts of the world. There was this very strong polemics between ANC, PAC, which sometimes reflected South African exiles, or SWANU, SWAPU, and so on and so forth, ZANU, ZAPU. I gathered from Frank's interview that he certainly didn't really engage in that sort of thing, or didn't have to worry about it. Was there any of this sort of ideological contestation going on?
Well, there was, but it was never at the heart of the Southern Africa Liberation Committee. You know, David would remember well one of our very serious contestations was with Leon Weaver, who was very deeply connected to Freedom House and to the Muzorewa Smith axis in what was then Rhodesia.
And who proposed a police training program for the South African police. And
right. and you know, I mean, and so we had contestations, but it was one of the upsides of a lack of intellectual interest, was no one was all that interested in what ANC's program was. And so they just supported black freedom without really seriously thinking what it looked like, what were the arguments for and against for different organizations. And there were some challenges. There was someone from SWANU in Southwest Africa. There was someone, you know, criticizing us for supporting MPLA in Angola because that was a communist organization. But for the most part, there was both a lack of interest, but also a lack of an exile community to really challenge us.
There actually were visits, a lot of visits from ANC, and a lot of visits from ZANU in Zimbabwe, which were not in the same harness together.
No.
But those issues were not raised during their presence, as as I remember.
Who were some of these visitors then in this period that you remember?
Well, I was teaching an Africa course, and I remember very clearly when Nathan Shamu Rivera lectured in my class, and Shamu, you know, he did a brilliant job, and I said, "There walks a real racist." Was my reaction to Shamu Rivera. We had other.
Edson Shvogbo was here from Chicago, from Fursano as well,
right?
A lawyer in training.
And I also
Tom Plowell was here representing ZAPU in that same period before he became the.
And Callistus and Blovu.
Callistus
and Blovu was here up for for ZAPU several times.
Right.
Shamararia, of course, now is still very much in Mugabe's cabinet.
And yes, he is.
So he'd been educated, I think, at Princeton.
He had a PhD from Woodrow Wilson School, and he taught in political science at university.
So what was it that struck you? Why did you give him this appellation? Was it his anti-ZAPU comments, or what was this?
It was his anti-white comments, and that there was zero place for any whites in his account of the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe. And it was such a dramatic and tremendous contrast, say, to Frelimo in Mozambique, which was open, to African National Congress, which was open. And I, you know, there were some whites, as I learned later, in ZANU at that time, but there was no place for them in his account or in his analysis. I have the notes, but I did not review them. But I still do have the notes that I took from when he gave the lecture.
There was a feeling as well, I think, with the many ANC visitors that there really was a strong control from the center of what was being said. And so even when one knew of the 1968 defeats of ANC and ZAPU inside Rhodesia, that would not be mentioned. And it was only the glorious victories of the people struggling against the white racism. And I think that actually led to some conversations from Michigan State with the ANC headquarters in New York and to sending out some people who could move beyond that.
It's one of the things, for example, that we debated very, very seriously in Toronto. And the consensus in Toronto was that Robert Mugabe was unstable. He did not have a good vision for Zimbabwe, and he would not get backing from Tikhlsek. And that was, and then that plays out in Ibo Mandaza's book, where he makes John Saul the villain. but that the origin is actually in the refusal by Tikhlsek to unqualified support for ZANU, and especially for Mugabe. In terms of African National Congress, that was a much more difficult and a very deep, heated, long discussion as to how to be able to be supportive and critical at the same time. Certainly that African National Congress was viewed as the leading and the one movement that would succeed in South Africa, but there were many very serious flaws in both their analysis and their political practice, but that you actually couldn't substitute your own judgment for theirs because they were both inside and outside. And so there was a closeness but a distance simultaneously, and a willingness to accept leadership from African National Congress, but also if there were times where there would be serious disagreement that would be expressed.
And I guess this, around about 76, 77, this became more prominent with the Soweto uprising. Other parts of the world, we saw great interest from students, particularly in what was happening in South Africa, black consciousness. And so I guess, did you see this at all at MSU? Was there an interest in the student population or the people that you were tutoring? And was there, an interest in Steve Biko's work? Because sometimes this was put as a counterpoint to the ANC. And it was some time, really, before the ANC was able to fully come to grips with what was happening there. So did you see a sort of, what I'm getting at here is a broadening of interest, not just in the official liberation movements, but in these you mentioned earlier.
Well, I think that was the real transition in the size and the capacity of Salk on campus, and it also led to really dropping Angola, Mozambique, kind of from the radar, and Namibia, and really much more exclusive focus on South Africa.
Right.
It's hard for me to say because I was gone for more than 2 years. I came back. Bud and Carol had left me, and they said, "Bill, you're now in charge. You are to do this, this, and this." That, you know, I mean, Bud was the most organized person in the world.
When did you come back?
I came back in the fall of 75. And Bud and Carol were on their way out. Bud was going to Chicago, and Carol had taken a position at University of Southern California. And they said, "We've begun this. Here it is. And your job is to get a resolution for City Council of East Lansing." And I had laid out some of that strategy because before I left, I had said our strategy should be first City Council, then the Board of Trustees, then the State of Michigan. It never dawned on me in my wildest dreams that Chris and Dave and a couple of state representatives could actually accomplish what they accomplished with the state. And so we actually did have a strategy, but Soweto and the tremendous focus on South Africa rose into a consciousness where, you know, most political leadership in the U.S. couldn't ignore South Africa the way they could before 1976 in Soweto. And so we were actually in a position, having a group, having a committed set of people, where we were actually able to move and to actually utilize that, I thought, in a very effective way.
So what happens in that campaign with the city council? Can you tell us about that?
Well, I don't remember all the details, David. You probably remember better than I do.
I don't think so.
But it was Bud and Carol who laid out the selective companies. And so since they had already begun that, I felt stuck with it. And so I tried to organize Salk to get groups of students to look at the different companies, Uniroyal or Coca-Cola or General Motors, that's an irony, as to what they were doing in South Africa and why Michigan State shouldn't invest in those companies. We then began trying to expand Salk. We used the movie Last Grave at Dimbaza as the most effective recruiting movie for raising the awareness. It was used all over campus. People engaged the Black Caucus at the time. It was shown in residence halls. In other words, there was a very substantial, fairly effective campus-wide campaign. And then Barb Thibault had become director of the Peace Center. We now had a Peace Center, and Barb and I went to ASMSU to tell ASMSU that they should be supporting this, and ASMSU basically didn't want to support it, and they wouldn't talk to us. And I was just, thinking about a point of view that was published in the state news, which just talked about the glibness, superficiality of ASMSU, and contrasted them to the student group whom we had talked to at East Lansing High School, who had given us 2 hours to ask us all kinds of questions and to, what was it about South Africa and so on and so forth. And luckily, our former librarian's son, Anna Mazera's son, who was a brilliant student.
Omeka, I think.
Yeah, and he took up the issue, and so East Lansing High School students, began to support it. And by the time we held a public hearing in East Lansing with East Lansing City Council, ASMSU came out to support it. I mean, and that's how widespread the discussions were. We met individually with all of the city council members. We lobbied them. It was not easy to get in to see them. A lot of argument about whether or not this was the proper role for a city and how could a city make foreign policy and so on and so forth. And so at each step along the way, And it was a really wonderful student group at the time with some really very fine graduate students. And then Dave and Mary Lee came sailing in. And that was before Dave. He was only associate director then, so he had a lot of time.
This was, what, 78, Dave?
Yeah.
There's one really interesting question for me there, and that's, you mentioned Anna Mazera's son, and that's the role of Africans from elsewhere in the continent in solidarity. There's this whole question of solidarity here, which is an interesting concept to think about. And also earlier you talked about how the university conference had this dual focus on racism in the States. As SOC started to grow, do you think that these solidarities started to develop? I mean, amongst, say, Nigerians or others who are at MSU, sometimes it was perhaps not as focused because they didn't identify with Southern Africa or South Africa, but was there this feeling of solidarity growing that you could draw upon, and maybe not just amongst Africans but African Americans increasingly?
Well, there had been, you know, Michigan State was, I think, one of the first universities which had a sit-in at its African Studies Center while we were at the African Studies Association meetings in Montreal. Was that 69? And that was a very, very, one would say now, Africanist, nationalist, exclusivist kind of perspective that they had, and it was really about more African participation in the center, more African participation in decision making, along with greater black participation. But by the time of 77, that whole set of radicals were gone, and the African Student Union was very apolitical. And it was caught up in a whole set of other things and didn't fully identify at all with a group of primarily white academics. And I don't think that we had much support, you know, from our African or African-American faculty. And in any event, there seems to be, and this is maybe, Peter, is interesting to you, you know, in the U.S., there continues to be this real separation between your academic work and your political work, and it was unthinkable for most faculty, white, black, African, whatever, to actually come to weekly meetings with students to do something. I mean, it was the very, very rare faculty member who was actually willing to make that commitment. And so we could identify Ruth Hamilton in sociology, or we could identify Mike Bratton in political, you know, if we needed a signature, if we needed, you know, if we needed something specific, we knew who to go to. But in terms of regular participation in that process of, you know, sustaining a movement, having a campaign.
So did this force you in a way into the community, into the wider community?
Oh, yeah. Like with black churches. Yeah, black churches. We spoke at all the black churches and tried to engage them. And, you know, and very often there was a lot of resistance. Who are you, a white person, to come and tell us about Africa? We have our own problems in Lansing. Why aren't you helping us to address these problems here? You know, but there was always, you know, some residual support. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the problems was that many of the African students coming to Michigan State in particular were very narrowly slotted on the agricultural and educational fields, very occupationally focused, and had not particularly come out of broad social science or humanities kind of background. The other thing I think was going on at that time was many of the African students were not necessarily with these major movements. They had not cast their lot in Southern Africa with those movements, and so they are always hedging their identities for the future. So they were in a difficult situation. They were in the United States that was also keeping them under inspection as well during their time here. So.
There were also Ethiopian students who were really deeply into Ethiopian politics. I mean, there could be highly political students, and so therefore it didn't lead them to see how their political agendas and their careers, you know, should be involved in this kind of a basically now a citywide effort to get the city of East Lansing to engage with apartheid.
Of course, there are big exceptions to this picture as well, like Kati Sateke, right?
Well, he was our one consistent South African presence during these years.
Right. As came out of the Soweto riots, a young seminarian in South Africa, and a Protestant seminarian, and then ANC self-appointed organizer for all of Michigan, while he took 6 or 8 years to get his BA degree in journalism.
But he did a lot of good work.
He did. He really activated a lot of people and supported the rest of Salk. So, Bill, to move on, so we get the selective buying campaign passed in the city council.
Well, that's transformed thanks to, because in the middle of this, just before you come, we get a copy of the resolution from Madison, which is all things being equal, the city won't invest in companies doing business with South Africa. And so that actually clears the way without naming anybody is a clear principle. And that was really a tremendous help to make it possible to actually pass something without all the tremendous repercussions. But we had public hearings, we debated the issue. Dow Chemical threatened to withdraw its funding because Dow was one of the companies named. I mean, and so those kinds of things, in a certain sense, could be finessed. The South African embassy sent someone, their chief lobbyist, to come to East Lansing to tell us why what we were doing was wrong, and that actually was of tremendous assistance to us, that South Africa thought that the city of East Lansing was important enough to make a difference. And so in that sense, I mean, I'm not quite sure what would have happened if he hadn't arrived. because it gave a face, and it gave a very clear white, self-serving face to the apartheid government.
Next comes the divestiture action at MSU. What are your recollections on that?
Oh, well, that of course was something that we had planned as soon as we got the city. we began the campaign for the Board of Trustees to take action, and we began doing the same kinds of things, which is going to student groups, going to residence halls, trying to set up appointments with the members of the Board of Trustees, and also addressing the Board of Trustees. And there was this, wasn't there, I have this recollection of this really huge meeting where you spoke, I spoke, many of the students spoke, and that much to our surprise, the Board of Trustees, rather than facing a long-term campaign against them, opted with Jack Stack and with Aubrey Radcliffe. Jack Stack said apartheid is slavery. Aubrey Radcliffe, that was his analysis. And so they were able to sway the Board of Trustees.
And we might add Aubrey Radcliffe as an African-American MSU PhD teaching in Lansing, and the Republican Party nominee to the Board of Trustees, who actually makes the resolution.
Well, Jack Stack was also a Republican.
Yeah, was it? Okay.
Yeah. And from Alma, he was a physician. Yeah. And so it was a very, and so they decided that it was the correct and moral thing to do. And Peter, going back to Soweto, I mean, it's that kind of public visibility of the South African issue that now makes it possible for leaders of American educational institutions, to take a more moral position. And certainly Michigan State distinguished itself in comparison to our neighbor down the road.
And so, as you just inferred, there was also now a bipartisan approach, more or less, with Republicans also willing to speak out.
Yes.
As this started to play out, how did, I mean, in the state legislature, I mean, was this an easy road to victory, or was there still a lot of battles to be won along the way?
This was when 1978.
78 is the divestiture action, I believe, and then 79 is the planning meeting of Virgil Smith, Perry Bullard, and Lynn Jondal, and myself, to talk about the ordering of the three bills, right, and which the first of which gets passed in 80 or 81, which is the banking bill, and so on. So, but at any rate,
and 80 and 81 were watershed years for me personally. I hadn't been back to Africa since 1974, and I was no longer doing any serious work, and I had to decide whether or not I was going to be a serious Africanist or whether or not I was, you know, going to give up Africa and look. And I had already begun exploring, doing research on Drummond Island, actually. And I decided I really wanted to go back to Africa. And so I withdrew for personal reasons, and plus I also found that the dynamics in Salt were such that many actions that the students wanted and the creativity of the students was actually being suppressed, and the meetings had become very unpleasant, and I didn't want to engage in battles with a couple of people who were very, very negative about almost any initiative that was off a very narrow path of either divestment or nothing. And I thought that was a tremendous mistake. And I just...
Well, was there no attempt to form other ancillary groups, or it was just,
no.
just one single group?
This was Southern Africa Liberation Committee. Then there were student groups. There was the diminishing resources of the Peace Center. Barb Thibault, who had been tremendously supportive, and you know, and she had been, you know, she had really done everything that Bud had done, you know, we had that organizational backup, which is really essential for sustained campaigns. And we had a meeting place, we had facilities, they would do all of our mailings for us. I mean, it was just...
So you used to have the meetings at the Peace Center?
Oh, yeah.
And they would do the mailing as well. So that was a great support. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And they were essential for the entire peace movement from the time that I arrived.
And that changed then later on?
Yes, because the United Ministries in Higher Education drove out the Peace Center, saying they couldn't afford them, it wasn't part of their mission, they wanted to focus more on personal salvation. Very much of a swing to the right by United Ministries in Higher Education.
Which had been pushed that way by their constituent churches, I think, that were funding them.
Right. But on the other hand, I don't know how much and how effectively, you know, they also held it up. Bud had left, the other person who was close to it had retired, and so there was this actually non-affiliated peace education center, which didn't have that kind of, you know, close connections to religious communities anymore. And so that became another complicating factor. And no, there was only one group. It was the Southern Africa Liberation Committee. It always had a student head, a student president, student vice president, you know, chair. And so it was a registered, affiliated student organization. But at the same time, it had open participation, both from community. Eric Williams was there. He was a lawyer. There were faculty, a couple, some people who were working, and some students. And of course, we had to have a student president in order to maintain the affiliation. And, you know, and when a group becomes too unpleasant, perhaps if I had been younger, if I didn't need to really go back to Africa, I might have, you know, really fought harder. But so I just withdrew and then just participated in actions as they arose.
To try and give the listeners some kind of picture of this organization, I mean, up until this period when you left, say, about 80, 81, were they meeting regularly? How many were at meetings? I mean, what did it look like? Can you paint a little picture of that? Did they meet monthly? Or
no, we met every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks.
And we did that for years.
Right.
And we always had an agenda. We had reports. I mean, people always talked about what they had done. And then I had built in kind of an internal education. I had tried to say once a month we should have a substantive meeting, and I tried getting people to read. And one of my dear colleagues in anthropology, David Dwyer, always opposed it, never did the reading.
He was too busy acting.
perhaps.
And how many would you roughly get? I guess it would fluctuate.
It fluctuated between 12 and 30.
That's a fair amount for an activist group.
Oh, I thought it was the largest activist group on campus for many years.
Right.
And it was supported in different directions, which was, you know, one of its strengths. And the African, to have a sympathetic African study center, always there, always available, always willing to help with a film or a speaker or something like that. I mean, that was always a tremendous asset. And that's something that most institutions didn't have. And also one could do it because it was a student organization. They initiated the activities, and they were Africa related, mm-hmm. so it didn't put the African Studies Center on the spot most of the time.
I think one of the other histories there that made a difference was that there was very little expertise on campus on Southern Africa. That MSU's focus had been heavily West and Horn of Africa and East Africa to some extent, and so there. A lot of faculty had not developed ties or expertise on it, so it was a big lacuna as well. The students came out with some actions in spite of such as the Coca-Cola boycott.
Right.
That do you have any recollections of that one?
No, I was not in. I was
you
not.
Were not
I was.
That,
I,
right?
No, no, I was not involved in the Coca-Cola boycott.
Well, we can
boycott.
Talk about that at one time, which was a difficult one, which succeeded at MSU in changing Coca-Cola machines. Pepsi, but I think had not taken seriously what it meant to take on Coca-Cola and its strong liaisons with the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. So that was
no, great. I was involved in the McGough campaign and also with the, which was a Salk activity.
Do you want to say a word about that?
Didn't Frank cover that?
It did, but it might, you might want to just summarize from your own perspective.
Well, that was where absolutely dogged activism won out, where showing up at every single performance in what was then the McGough Theater with signs McGough off, although I'm not quite sure, it's not the most best of slogans perhaps, but it was very effective. And showing up with leaflets, and that was Annabelle and Dave Dwyer and Frank and
Mary Lee,
Mary Lee and Pat.
And Annabelle.
Yeah, Annabelle, I said, yeah. And they just, and so, you know, my participation, I just, at that point, I felt a bit like a, kind of a, just a real faculty member. I came in and I would speak to the Board of Trustees, or if a point of view needed to be written for the paper, I wrote a point of view for the paper, and of course we were tremendously helped by all the revelations from South Africa as to how McGough had gotten the money and that he hadn't returned it. And so the question, which was a very genuine and real question, which Salk asked and which was asked by David, by everybody, was how did we know that this wasn't some of the stolen money? And could McGough assure us that this money wasn't stolen? And of course he couldn't, and so I don't know in the end how it was negotiated.
Like any of us do.
But quite clearly there were behind the scenes negotiations, and McGough was just a horrible character, and very volatile with a terrible temper and bridged no dissent in his news organizations and so on.
And under censorship of the American Journalist Association for his. Journalism,
Nonetheless, he was rewarded with the Journalism Prize by Michigan State University School of Journalism, which was just outrageous.
That, of course, raises the question of the attitude of the administration more generally in these years, from the 70s, and we could talk maybe a little bit about the 80s, although you're back to Africa by then. How would you characterize the attitude of the MSU administration on the whole question of apartheid?
Wonderfully paternalistic. They so much like students' concern for people around the world, but certainly there was nothing that Michigan State University could do. And so they were not hostile, but they didn't see any sense in which they should be personally and morally responsible for taking actions which would support the ending of apartheid. They didn't see that as the professional role, and so they always placed fiduciary responsibility above any moral and political concerns. Is that it? And you know, the Dean of International Programs, I mean, they never showed up at our rallies, they never showed up at our meetings, they never offered to speak. I mean, it was left to, you know, a few people to really go out on a limb and feel like they were, you know, acting without any official support from the university or even from their own colleges or departments.
Although I guess we know of no faculty that lost their jobs at MSU for their stance on unlike University of Michigan, right?
Right, and very different than the anti-war movement, where we lost wonderful faculty who had been active in the anti-war movement and who were forced out, who were not given tenure, and during those years no reasons had to be given. They were told that they were not collegial.
Maybe we could switch tack also and talk a little bit about your shift back to Africa and research. Is that when you become more deeply involved in Zimbabwe studies, or is that a little bit later?
No, that's later. I went to back to West Africa. There was an opportunity to direct the research program on dams and irrigation in the Gambia River Basin, which included my old stopping ground of Guinea as well as the Gambia and Senegal. And so I went and I did that, and that was a very mixed experience because I was operating as part of a team, but it wasn't really a team that set out common research objectives. But I learned a tremendous amount, and it really got me back into Africa. But what really got me into Zimbabwe was something that Dave once again, you know, organized and was really connected to the anti-apartheid movement. I mean, one of the things that I did when I was more active was I spoke at Eastern Michigan University and was helped organize, you know, students there. And then the Michigan group, their anti-apartheid alliance, asked me to come and address the Michigan Board of Trustees. And so I addressed the Michigan Board of Trustees, where I once again learned about how silence is power, and when people in power are challenged, they just don't ask questions and they don't say anything. And you know, so it made no difference that I was a graduate and so on and so forth. But Dave began thinking about how should funds, which were now being made available for South Africa in education, how could they most effectively be used, and how could the different liberation movements and educators in Southern Africa actually, you know, what were they saying about how resources should be used? And so I was very happy to join the group and do whatever I could, and I, of course, assumed that it would be Dave Wiley and Ruth Hamilton who would go to Southern Africa and sort of make the connections, especially with exiles from ANC and also internal education activists. And so for reasons that I still don't understand to this day, Dave bowed out, Ruth bowed out, and that led to Dave Gordon and myself representing Michigan State University in this huge effort, which was now being funded by ironically by the MSU Foundation, along with Kellogg, and so I went with someone who I later learned never would speak against the United States when he left the United States, and so it was the Dave and Bill show, because I couldn't accept what Dave Gordon was saying about U.S. policies and so on and so forth, and he wouldn't criticize the U.S. And so that led him to have very bizarre analyses, I thought, of Southern Africa. And so we traveled together. I went myself to ANC in Lusaka. And then that's when I met the entire leadership of SWAPO, actually. And I went from ANC there to Habarone. And lo and behold, there was Bill Martin. In Habarone, and so Bill Martin and I drove into Johannesburg together, And so I began meeting with members of the underground.
This was what, 80, 81?
This is 86, at the height of the state of emergency.
Right, right.
This is 1986. I'm done with my West Africa work. And so this was my entree back into Southern Africa. I'd never been there before. And so in my first introduction to Johannesburg was I stayed in the Johannesburg International Hotel, which was hosting a meeting of the Steelworkers Union, which is 100% black. And so the hotel was filled with black workers.
No, sir. So you were there to look at grants or fellowships or building partnerships?
I was there to recruit people to come to our conference, actually, and to help develop a strategy for education for South Africans and Namibians, and to develop a set of principles, as it turns out, as to what to do with the funds for divestment. In other words, if funds were becoming available, how should those funds be used in the U.S.? What principles should be followed? And so that led to this big international conference at Michigan State with members of SWAPO, ANC, inside, outside.
Even in LA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who were some of these African leaders that you met in Lusaka or Gaborone or Joburg? Do you remember any of them?
What was Andrew Masondo?
Oh, yes.
Was head of education in Lusaka, yes. Oh. And he was. And then I met Chitendero, who is the education, becomes Minister of Education, but then moves up in SWAPO. And what was the.
Ben Gurirab, I think, was there.
Ben Gurirab was there. But he didn't come.
He didn't come.
Yeah,
and was this consolidated? I mean, beyond the conference, did it lead to some long-term relationships or links?
Well, it really did, in the sense that Michigan State. I mean, one of the outcomes of any event like this is bringing together people who hadn't been able to meet.
Hmm.
And so we brought together this guy Merle from Cape Town, who was this amazing, science teacher and. Eric's, I'm blocking on his last name, do you remember? Eric Malobe, who was doing the National Education Coordinating Committee, and he would appear in my hotel room at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I met with, experts at Western Cape, UCT, Joburg. I paid a call at the University of Botswana. One of our graduates who was then vice chancellor. it led to this.
So you were really a trailblazer then in MSU's direct contacts with South Africa.
We were at that point because we had to travel to New York to meet with the ANC representative to the United Nations. It took an enormous amount of effort. And Ruth and Dave did a lot of that, to try and facilitate their agreement and approval. And then we had to fight enormously, people like Bud and Carol, who said it was treasonous, to go to South Africa.
Because you weren't doing it through the ANC, were doing it independently.
No, we were doing it through the ANC, but they still thought it was wrong. They had a very moral position, you don't go to South Africa. And Bud and Carol, especially Carol, was incredibly moralistic to me, and Bud was, Bud in the end was at least willing to continue talking to me. I mean, of course they came around, but still it was very hard at the time. No, but it brought together inside, outside, ANC, SWAPO, in ways that they could formulate their own principles for what should happen, where education should be taking place.
Because they were already looking at negotiations. I mean, they're already underway in Dakar and Lusaka. There were talks about talks. And so this is something I think some people in the anti-apartheid movements didn't quite understand, this sort of networking that began in the mid-80s. And it was complicated, I guess, for you.
It was complicated, but we didn't have any second thoughts, and certainly none of the participants. There was zero criticism. Mm. They were absolutely delighted to come to Michigan State. They were delighted to focus on education issues. They used the time here very, very productively.
Mm.
And so that conference brought in USAID, Rockefeller, Ford, Mellon, et cetera, to talk to them about how they use their monies. There having been a history of South African regime nominated candidates having gotten the money.
Right.
Right. Yeah, previously.
And that's right. We brought John Samuel.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, and so it was a place for them to also, you know, solidify their networks, their connections. And,
so would you assess this as being a significant contribution that you and MSU were able to make in sort of nudging these people away from this more conservative approach?
Yes.
MSU was able to do that because of the divestiture action.
Right.
Because so much of the educational money in this country from the previous decade had been from institutions that were doing it instead of a sanctions policy of some kind.
Well, Michigan State did have that reputation, both through divestment, but also, I mean, it's just kind of really supportive of liberation movements. I mean, it goes with Mike and Dave doing news cuttings for ZANU. I mean, there was just a whole series of things. Bud and Carol had always been tremendously supportive of liberation movements. And, you know, and so people, activists here, you know, just simply included liberation movements. And I have the feeling that that made an enormous difference.
Mm-hmm. And it led to ANC bringing their only ever North American Congress for all South Africans to MSU campus in 90, which is, I think, directly came out of your visits in that conference.
And, but that's when I made the switch, and so I went back to Zimbabwe. And a long answer to a very short question.
Maybe we talked a lot about South Africa. What about a little bit on Zimbabwe then? When did you first go to Zimbabwe, and then how did you get into working on these grassroots issues like land and water?
I went in through... I really wanted to work with a university, and there was the Center for Applied Social Sciences, which was an interdisciplinary unit headed by someone from an old missionary family who many people knew, but including Dave Wally knew. And at that time, he was, you know, he thought it would be wonderful if I would come and work with Cass. He never imagined that I would wind up, you know, being the longest expatriate working with him. And the first thing he had me do was to actually write a research paper on the implications of river basin development in West Africa for Zimbabwe. And then it was published in their working paper series, and he used it as part of his Ford Foundation grant. But I began working in the Zambezi Valley with a lot of other researchers, but I focused on agriculture where they were really focusing on wildlife and conservation. My own view on wildlife and conservation is that's great, but that's not how most Zimbabweans are going to actually make a living, and that's fine for a few people, but it actually is irrelevant for most. And that's when I began. And then I began focusing on a resettlement project. I had always had an interest in resettlement from West African days, and so I got to actually study a resettlement project, which puts you very much into issues of land tenure, security, government planning, technocracy, is there any local level participation, and of course it put me very much into local politics, because ZANU-PF couldn't disagree with government policy, but yet at the same time the local political leadership was very unhappy with the project. And so it leads very rapidly into that. And then I did some broader work on the valley as a whole. And then I was very excited because they wanted linked to land resettlement is also issues of water. So then I began, and no one was working on water in those years.
What years was this? Is this in the 80s?
Well, I began in 87. Right. And so I went every year, and I finished the work on the Mid-Zambezi project around 93. And then I began working on land use planning for 94, 95. And then I switched to the water law, water reform, implementation, you know, of a public participatory approach in water management. And that's through 2003. In the meantime, we dashed off the Fragile Lands, Fragile Lakes project. I learned from that, never try to do two projects at the same time. I'm not capable of it.
You'd also been
I was also working in Malawi.
You've been involved in the Great Lakes project MSU.
Bill, as you look back on this long period at MSU and the kind of the activism that you came out of U of M and then at MSU helped to form and participate in, how do you look at the present time, the present students, the present MSU in retrospect?
I look at my younger colleagues and I guess I worry. Professionalization is a good thing, but being a citizen is equally as important. And what I see is an overwhelming absorption with the hoops of tenure and the very high demands made upon our younger faculty to actually meet all of these standards. And it's leading families to delay having children or not having children at all. It's leading to all kinds of, I think, fairly destructive patterns. And it's also decreasing the possibility of real public engagement. And if people do become publicly engaged, it has to be very much connected to their professional expertise. Gone, I think, are the time for the Dave Dwyers of the world who could be an activist on Southern Africa but be a linguist. And so there was no connection between his professional work and his citizen activism. And so I think that's become much harder, and so it's more difficult until the next crisis, you know. And a real sign of that is the very small number of Michigan State faculty who were involved against the war in Iraq. In many ways, in my perspective, the war in Iraq is worse than the war in Vietnam. And the threats in Vietnam to the U.S. actually were much greater than they are in Iraq, despite all of the propaganda. And I am a bit surprised at the low level of activism at Michigan State, both among students and faculty. And it's hard to know whether students are working so hard they have to hold multiple jobs in order to succeed in staying here, and that's diminishing their intellectual and their physical energy. It's a culture of consumption rather than activism. And so a lot of the people who are most active in the anti-war movement, for example, are actually community members and older activists and a few students, but surprisingly few. It'll be very interesting to see what happens on campus with the referendum on affirmative action and whether or not Michigan State, you know, for example, administration will feel that will be a direct attack upon higher education in Michigan and organize, and how that will play out here, if that will lead to a greater birth or rebirth of activism. So while the country as a whole is coming out of an acquiescence to some horrible policies, I don't see yet any spurt of energy here, but of course that may very well change.
Bill, thank you very much.
Sure.
Very interesting comment on a very interesting career.
Well, let's hope it's not quite over yet.
Thanks very much.